All right. Argumentation, debate. And I asked you to sort of look at your different things. We're not going to decide on what we're going to debate until next week, and then Graham's not going to be here. That's terrible. So tell me when we finish, you tell me what you want to do. But I want to try to get to discussing this, because next week we'll start to pick teams, and we'll start to hammer this thing out. Critical thinking. I think everybody's a critic, but I don't think people think critically. There's something called constructive criticism that is a very important way to think, and I want to try to show you how to apply that to debate. Studying your view. I think a lot of people have a view of life and a view of the Bible and a view of God and so on and so forth, and they don't know where they got it from. Maybe they got it from a pastor, maybe they got it from a book they read or a video they watched, and all that may be helpful. But critical thinking actually thinks through what you believe, why you believe it. So we're going to learn what questions to ask and seek answers to in preparation for an argument or a debate. All right, evidence and research. A debate round, when we get into debates, a debate round can be compared to an argument between two lawyers in a courtroom. Wait a minute, didn't we finish?
No.
Oh, don't tell me that. I'm sorry. Oh, crap. I'm always ahead. I like reading and then like, oh, I can't wait to teach this. We stopped. Didn't we go through the Truman model?
Yeah, we stopped on many kinds of fallacies.
Ah, drat. Okay. Okay. Many kinds of logical fallacies. Hmm.
Read this, whatever, if
you give us a bit of... Yeah, well, let me see. This will be on the test. Let me talk this through with you because it is important. I try to go very quickly, but a logical fallacy, all right? You'll frequently come up against these fallacies, and I will challenge you on these things. When you are debating, I will mark off, and I'll go, oh, Graham used a slippery slope argument. Okay, and Eddie used a hasty generalization, and you need to know what these are. So you go, oh, I know what I did. So watch. Logical fallacies can be very hard to identify, especially when you really believe something and you've never tested it, and somebody actually challenges you on it. You go, no, it has to be true, and you don't realize you're believing it for the wrong reason. Many people are swayed by these types of arguments instead of by actually analyzing what they believe. If you can learn to recognize and understand the errors in others' reasoning, you'll be able to present a more organized and understandable rebuttal of their arguments, whether in debate or in everyday life. Learning to think logically and spot logical fallacies is the cornerstone of effective debate. A logical fallacy is an argument that is illogical. Spock would be proud. It does not make logical sense or follow the rules of logic. It is therefore a false argument. Did Jesus ever say, well, just believe it? Or did he say, well, it is written? Or he would say, wait a minute, what about when this occurred? And he would logically analyze their argument versus what the Bible said. So, using your sense. So, fallacy of composition. This fallacy occurs when the conclusion of the argument transfers the characteristics of a part onto the whole. Just because one thing you're saying may be true doesn't mean everything you're saying is true. Does that make sense? So, let's all say that all men are human beings. Is that a true statement? Yes. To conclude from this that all human beings are men would be false. Just because all men are human beings doesn't make all human beings men. Another example would be to say that each player on a team is excellent. Therefore, the team is excellent. That's not true. All right, the team could be a failure because they don't get along. They do that all the time over there in England, all the sports teams. They have great players, but they can't get along. What is true about the parts may not be true about the whole. So it's called a fallacy of composition. You're trying to make your truth fit the whole composition, B or E. Fallacy of division. It is the opposite of composition. It applies the characteristics of the whole to the part. the team is excellent, therefore all the players are excellent is an example of this fallacy. You may have some poor players, but the better players make up for them. And you say, well, all of them must be perfect. No. I mean, here, somebody sees one of my daughters, say they see Ruth, and they go, look at Ruth, such a perfect, all your children must be perfect. No, that's a fallacy of division. Just because you meet one child and you say, well, the Ledbetter children all must be perfect. First of all, you don't know my daughter very well, if you think that. And then secondly, you think that they're all, that's a fallacy. You don't make that conclusion. F, slippery slope. It's a popular fallacy. In this fallacy, the conclusion rests upon an event setting off a chain reaction. Now, a lot of preaching can sometimes be built upon a slippery slope because we've been there. I can get up and I can say, you keep your phone on, somebody's going to phone you at 3 in the morning. You keep it on, somebody, some kid, is going to be one of your friends, is going to be bored and can't sleep and is going to bother you at 2 in the morning. Now, that's not always true, but I'll build a slippery slope and say, and once you start getting calls or you're texting, you get in the habit of it, and then they'll have your heart and your attention. You're not sleeping, you're not preparing for school, and your most of your nightlife is now at night texting or Facebook or whatever. That's a slippery slope argument. I'll start off with, this starts, and this is where you're going. Now, I may be perfectly right, but I can be challenged. Are you sure that that will happen? No, I'm not sure. But I'm a dad, and I'm going to make sure it won't happen. You see where I'm going. But your argument cannot be that because you take this first step, it is guaranteed to arrive down here. That may not be true. So your preaching has to be careful, all right? I've been around 31 years as a Christian. I can talk about Christian rock. I can talk about how people, they start to reduce their standards on music. They start to reduce their standards on drinking or anything. I know where it's leading. But it's a fallacy of the slippery slope. That somebody can always challenge me and says, can you prove that? I can give you evidence, but I cannot prove that it will happen in your life for sure, for sure. Okay? So in debate, you can't use slippery slope arguments. That may be true in the real world, and you may passionately believe you can't use them. All right? Debate has to be, if you're going to debate, you're going to have to allow, yeah, maybe there are going to be people who don't fall into sin because of such things. All right? Does that make sense? Am I losing you or are you with me? Okay, so this is in debate. And when you're soul winning and you say, well, you know, if you don't get saved, you're going to die and go to hell. I say that. But guess what? They may get saved 10 years later. And they won't die and go to hell. If they don't get saved now, you're going to die and go to hell. What I mean is, if you were to die right now, you would go to hell. But I imply, well, you made a decision and you are going to end up in hell. Be careful, because they're going to go, how do you know that they're not going to get saved in a few years? I don't. But my statement is not careful. All right? So you got to be careful. When you're in debate, I'll rock it off, I go, you made a slippery slope argument, a conclusion based on the first step. All right? That's prejudging. You're looking at me like I'm losing you. So a chain reaction that culminates in an undesirable consequence, yet there is not sufficient proof that the chain of reactions will be triggered. The idea behind this fallacy is that you're standing at the top of a hill, and one little step will cause you to slip all the way down and crash to the bottom. An example of this fallacy would be the argument that if we don't provide government-funded health care for every citizen in our country, vast amounts of people won't be able to afford medical care. That's the slippery slope argument. And they'll all get sick, and they'll all suffer horribly and die, and all society will collapse. That's how all government programs are created, by the slippery slope argument. That's how America was convinced to allow abortions. They said 2 million women have suffered in back alleyways because they didn't have access to medical facilities to give them abortion. Did you know less than 10,000 abortions were done over a period of 50 years leading up to the Roe versus Wade decision in 1972 to allow abortions. But they said 2 million. They said, if we don't provide this, millions more women will suffer. That's a slippery slope argument. If we don't do this, then this is going to happen. That's why when you get a politician up there, he says, we have to act. If we don't create this new program to take care of these teenagers who aren't going to school, they will end up on the street. Now, that may happen, but that's a slippery slope argument, and it'll appeal to our emotions. That's not why you start a program, okay, in a government. All right. In order to avoid this fallacy, be sure to require sufficient evidence to support each step leading to conclusion. Hasty generalization. To generalize is to say that everyone or everything in particular, in a particular class, is alike in all their ways. For instance, the statement, women are overly emotional, is a generalization about women. Another one is, men are insensitive. Now, everybody says amen to both of them, don't they? Yeah, women are so emotional. Men are so insensitive. But those are generalizations. Wouldn't you agree with that? Both of these statements are false, since not all women are overly emotional and not all men are insensitive. You cannot base your arguments on a hasty generalization about people or events. H. Circular reasoning. Circular reasoning occurs when the cause of some effect is itself caused by the same effect. For example, if I were to say that I am a truthful person because I say that I am truthful. Okay. But did you know every evolutionist bases all of their evidence on circular reasoning? They'll stand over here and there'll be all of these layers, sedimentary layers. And the point to one is, this is 70 million years ago. And they'll say, somebody will ask it, how do you know that? Because it's found in this layer. Oh, how do you know that? Well, because of these layers. This stone, this shell is 70 million years old because it's found in a layer. Then they'll walk over here and they'll find the stone and they'll go, this stone is 70 million years old. How do you know that? Because it's found, the circular reasoning goes, I'm trying to remember how it works. The stone, or the shell, is 70 million years old because it's found in this layer that they think is 70 million years old. And then they'll come over here and they'll look at all these layers and they'll go, how do you know that layer is 70 million years old? Because it has a stone in there that we found that is 70 million, or a shell that's 70 million years old. They make both true by each other, not by actual evidence. And that is the greatest way to befuddle an evolutionist, is that, show me how you know it's 70 million years old. You cannot base your arguments, evolutionists use this kind of reasoning to back up their theories as well with the strata model. Equivocation. Equivocation occurs when you change the meaning of a term in the middle of an argument. And you'll be talking about works versus grace and salvation by faith versus works. And as you're defending your position, all of a sudden you adjust the meaning because you see you're losing. that's called waffling. That's what politicians do. Well, I didn't really mean it to mean that. No, you better have your definitions really locked tight before you get in debate, because everybody will go, ha, he's equivocating, he's waffling. And most religions do this constantly.
Sorry, Pastor, isn't that a hasty generalization? Most religions do this constantly.
It may be, but I have found it to be true. I believe that whenever I talk to a religion, they will present their thing until they start to get questioned, and then they all, that I've experienced, will change their meanings. I'll deal with a priest, and you start talking to them about once for all, and they go, I was sure, and they begin to change the meaning of their doctrine to fit what you're now saying. They waffle. They don't want it to mean that we need a continuation of the sacrifice.
So if the generalization is true, then it's okay, is it?
No, technically, a generalization always has to be shot down. Except in my class where I'm teaching, you're not allowed to shoot.
We won't be today.
Yes, a generalization always has to be shot down. Unless there's a generalization that all humans, have souls. That's a generalization. I haven't checked every human, but I know the Bible tells me that everybody who is alive has a soul. So there are generalizations that I cannot verify that are true. Okay, and I said this, I just said most religions do this, and when I say constantly, it doesn't mean they do it every breathing moment. It just means that they do it without even thinking. It's a constant thing of, we adapt to our debater. Okay, I've seen it in debates where you have a priest and you have a Baptist pastor, and they're debating on on the Catholic Church and on salvation, and that priest, so the whole conversation becomes more and more like a Baptist. Because he doesn't want to seem so different. A Mormon says, well, we're a Christian. Oh, we believe the Bible. Oh, we believe it's by says we're being saved by Jesus. That's equivocation. If you read their documentation of what they really believe, they're totally different. But they equivocate. They change their positions. Arguing that the federal government should ban handguns. A lot of this stuff comes from America, I know, but just follow along. Arguing that the federal government should ban handguns and then supporting this conclusion by listing all the harms of allowing machine guns to be sold is an example of this fallacy. Halfway through your argument, you changed what you meant by the word gun. I mean, everybody would say machine guns. Well, Rambo, we should ban all handguns. That's not a handgun, okay? You guys may not understand that humor. I think it's great. The reason why machine guns are not safe may be different why handguns may not be safe. As a matter of fact, I think in America, because guns are legal in America, everybody should be allowed to have a handgun. I believe that. In a shopping mall, nobody would get away with more than one shot. Because you'd have, here's grandma, she'd put a gun and shoot that guy shooting in the middle of the mall. You just would never allow somebody to get away with the kind of stuff. You get guys who go into a post office and he gets away with killing 25 people before they finally tackle him. If another person had a gun in there, he'd only get one shot off. He said, well, he got one shot. If it wasn't a gun, he'd bring in something else to kill somebody with.
Where would you draw the line?
You don't!
Because you'd be in school with all of handguns.
Okay? No, we're talking about age group now. Now you change the argument from do handguns protect or do they only hurt? And I'm saying that if handguns are out there, and they are. Somebody had a bumper sticker that said, when they criminalize handguns, only criminals will have handguns. That doesn't make me feel any safer. That doesn't do anything. But if I have right of self-defense, and somebody pulls out a gun and starts shooting it, I can defend myself. Otherwise, quick, come, I'm about to die, this guy is getting ready to point at me, I've got no hope in the guard of coming.
I agree with all what you're saying. That statement, once you sort of generalized it, but it's true here in Ireland. So
of course it is.
Guns.
Of course.
Generally.
And I think that if somebody breaks into my house, I
have a gun. Can you call me a criminal?
Well, the government would. The government would if it's, yeah.
My use it properly.
But coming back to here, you got to realize that, machine guns are different, okay, than a handgun, I believe. Handguns are, when I was traveling, on deputation before I came to Ireland, I would have my family in the car. We would have to pull over at these rest stops, and I had a missionary tell me, "Get you a gun, a handgun. Keep it in your shoe there, on a strap on your leg, because if somebody ever came to your door and wanted and broke your window and got in there, and you're at a lay-by, an all-night one of these lay-bys, and you're just resting there, somebody could do some serious damage, and you could stop them if you had a small little 20 caliber." 22 caliber gun, you could stop him from, you're not going to kill him, but you're going to stop him with that thing, get three shots off, and then run, man.
Did you get one?
No, I didn't.
Because?
As a missionary, okay, I tried rarely ever to stop. I tried never to put myself into that thing. I didn't grow up with a gun, okay? And to just say, I'm going to go get a gun, I don't have the mindset for it. I believe in the right of gun ownership, but I didn't have the mindset. I might have left that thing off the safety. My kids might have gotten it, and I was afraid that I would not be able to adequately protect my children as much as I want to protect others. So there's a balance there. I'm not for all, let's all get guns. Giving people who don't know what they have guns would be stupid as well. But allowing people to be trained to have guns, I mean, I'm speaking blasphemy in Europe here. But I believe that because it is self-defense, all right? When you get into debates, you have to step out and go, is it the guns that are bad? No, the guns aren't bad, okay? Yeah, so appeal to the people. This fallacy is very popular in today's culture, especially in advertising. It's a everybody's doing it appeal. For example, someone might say, only extremists believe that abortion is wrong. 70% of Americans believe that abortion should be allowed in some cases. Did you know that over 60% of Americans right now believe that abortion is wrong in almost all conditions except where the life of the mother is at stake? I mean, that has changed. But But that doesn't make abortion right or wrong just because it's popular or not. But that is the argument going on right now. This argument is an appeal to our desire to be normal. Oh, I don't want to be different. When others will, whom others will love and esteem, and I don't want to be an extremist who will be shunned. So these arguments are especially harmful to meaningful debate because the validity of an argument is not measured by how popular it is. Like the argument about homosexuality right now. The argument is always, always an appeal to people. Only religious extremists think homosexuals are evil. I don't believe they're evil. That's not the point. See how the first that's an argument of fallacy. I don't believe they're evil. I don't believe they're sinning. I believe that what they do is evil, but I don't believe they're evil. Appeal to pity. In this fallacy, the arguer tries to evoke pity to motivate her listener to appeal to accept the claim. I mean, oh, that's how you get an argument with a woman. She'll always appeal to pity. You don't care. I do care, but the argument... Men are insensitive! Oh.
You're right.
Yeah.
The next point.
You guys said no one!
We know where you're right. Right. Next point. I'm a real chauvinist pig, and I'm proud of it.
Here. People commonly use this appeal when they're faced with punishment. But officer, you can't give me a speeding ticket. I was rushing my wife to the hospital. Now that may be true, but he's also got to protect the other people on the street that you might be running over. The fact that someone's wife needs to go to the hospital does not technically excuse him from obeying the speed limit. The law does not say you must obey the speed limit, except if your wife needs to go to the hospital. Also, did you know that these guys who drive these ambulances and fire trucks, they are not protected under the law? If they do ever exceed the law, the speed limit, and go through a red light, they do it at their own risk. And if they have an accident, they are sued, they may go to jail. They do it very riskily, okay? That's why you see them still going the speed limit, because they're not protected. The speed limit is a speed limit, all right? This fallacy is used in debate when an arguer appeals to the judge's sense of pity rather than offering logical evidence to support the argument. So don't try to get my pity, okay, when you're trying to make your argument. Appeal to authority. This, and they'll do that with spanking. I'll give you somebody was we got slapping a child. They'll go, "How can you spank a 6-month-old?" Now they're appealing to pity. Don't talk to me about. I don't want to spank anybody. I don't want to slap them on the behind. But a 6-month-old who digs her heels in and looks you in the eye and goes, "Mmm," doesn't have to say no. Just "Mmm." A little swat to the back. They'll say, "Me boss." Okay. And that point, it's not that, oh, I just couldn't do that. That little girl or boy is going to become a big demon if you don't bring control. Yes, sir?
The argument's wrong, huh?
Which wrong?
About the 6-month-old digging its heels in. You can't walk at that stage. It's just 6 months.
Yeah.
You meant 6 years?
I didn't mean 6 years. I meant 6 months. And digging his heels in is a rhetorical term, but it's also it's just a symbolic term. It just has a meaning that I thought you would get.
You're right.
Appeal to authority. This fallacy occurs when you cite an authority or a witness who is not qualified. Well, my mother, she has this, you know, she has this way of talking. She always told me that, okay, her mother may have a great wisdom, but she's not the authority to quote. Using a quote from a heart specialist as evidence that a new type of medicine will cure lung cancer is an example of faulty appeal to authority. That's why in courts, the expert witnesses are really tested to find out, are they really a witness? A heart specialist does not have the authority to make an accurate judgment on lung cancer. Watch for this fallacy when your opponents cite an authority as evidence. Make sure the authority is qualified. Another example is when someone appeals to their church for what to believe instead of to the only qualified authority, which is the Bible. You'll get a Jehovah's Witness, and they'll always quote from the Watchtower, or they'll quote from some prophet. You'll get it with the Seventh-day Adventists. They'll come along, and they'll quote from Ellen G. White. And you'll go, what does the Bible say? And that's where they use wrong evidence. Another example, okay, non sequitur. This fallacy is known as missing the point. And this is most discussions you ever get with somebody. My words are always, you're missing the point. You ever say that? Do you ever see that? You ever hear that say? That is the modern thing of, all of a sudden they're on another whole argument. You go, but my point is, you don't get my point. So the Latin terms means this, it does not follow. That's what non sequitur means. It does not follow. Your statement doesn't follow what I just said. The fallacy occurs when the premises, the beginning, the foundation of the argument, seem to lead up to a particular conclusion, but a completely different conclusion is drawn. An example would be when a person states that it's freezing cold and the wind is blowing, so we should go sledding. Okay. Usually those two things say we should stay inside, but it doesn't follow that you should go sledding if it's freezing cold and the wind is blowing. The conclusion to go sledding does not follow the statements it's freezing cold and windy. So many people talk this way, though most don't even recognize it. We make conclusions. You know, we see the sun, we go, we might as well stay inside. That doesn't, I mean, it's sunny. The following conclusion would be, so we should be able to go outside. N, ad hominem attacks. In Latin, it simply means attack on the man. If you ever are in a losing argument where somebody is not doing well in their argument with you or debating with you, they will always change to this argument. They'll always attack you. Mm-hmm. It simply means attack on the man. By definition, this fallacy, I mean, here's two lawyers, and they'll be presenting their evidence, and this one is losing his case, and so he'll say, well, that lawyer's not a very good lawyer. That's to get the attention off of the evidence onto the man, okay? You'll say it at the door. You'll be a soul winner. I'll be knocking on the door, and I'm telling them the gospel. And when they are losing the argument, they'll look and go, where are you born? Where are you from? You're not from here, are you? All of a sudden, their goal is to now make me the problem. You're not from here, are you? That tells me I'm winning. He's under conviction, and I just keep pressing on and keep going at it. So, listen, I'm from America, but I've been here 17 years, and this is eternal. Boom. You just got to get back on the track. It is a deceptive argument because the arguer responds to his or her opponent by focusing on the person rather than on the validity of the argument in question. An ad hominem attack is abusive in that it involves a personal attack like in the debates that you saw. McGinnis just made a personal attack. He wasn't bringing up evidence. Everybody knows it was dirty Irish politics as usual. So two particularly deceptive forms of this argument are circumstantial attacks and tu quanque, which in a circumstantial attack, an arguer alludes to certain circumstances that affect his or her opponent. So-and-so is a millionaire and would benefit from a reduction to the income tax. Ooh. I mean, like somebody saying, well, Craig is for gun control because he loves guns. Actually, I don't like guns at all. Never had one. Never plan on owning one. I just believe in self-defense. Do you understand how it works? But somebody will say, well, you must really love guns. No, not at all. I just believe in self-defense. You see how it works? That's an attack on the man. In tu quanque attack, the speaker shifts the burden of guilt back onto the opponent by saying, you, too, are guilty of this error. All right, so you're arguing with your wife. And you say, you're not listening. Well, you've never listened to me all our marriage. an ad hominem. You're now attacking me. I'm just trying to get you to listen to me. You see how it works? John, are you paying attention? You're every time you try to make your point to your wife, she'll always say, well, you're not doing it either. Well, so what? But that's how it comes out. An example would be if your dad yells at you about not yelling, and you respond, but you're yelling.
My kids yell at me all the time.
I know.
My wife.
Yeah. That's right. You're grumpy. Oh, I'm going to get grumpy here in a minute if you don't listen. That's oh, man. Straw man. This popular fallacy occurs when the arguer twists the real argument and then attacks a twisted argument. He sets up somebody else, and he says, this is the argument. All of a sudden, a third point is made. It is the opponent creating a new target for you two to focus on instead of the original one. As with the non sequitur fallacy, the arguer is avoiding the real issue instead distorting his or her opponent's arguments for the purpose of a more easily attacking item. You say, we should abolish the Department of Education. Your opponent responds, we can't abolish the public education in this country. How would our children receive an education? Did the person say get rid of public education or say get rid of the Department of Education? There's a difference. I'll give you an example. Ken Hovind was up there, and it was absolutely classic. He was demolishing all the lies in the textbooks. And textbook after textbook, he said, here's a lie in the textbook, here's a lie in the textbook. You should not teach lies in the national schools. And the guy stood up and he said, well, if you don't have textbooks, man, what are you going to teach? And as gentlemanly as he could, without laughing his head off, Ken Hovind looks at him and he says, you teach science! You just don't teach the lies. And the guy says, but if you take that stuff out, there's nothing else to teach. And the guy was going, no, you just take out the lies. But the guy was thinking of another argument that Kent Hovind was saying, don't teach science at all. And for 15 minutes, he kept trying to get the guy to realize in the debate that I'm not saying don't teach science. I'm saying don't teach lies in the science textbooks. And the guy goes, but what are we going to teach? This was a student who was just arguing. People will see a different argument than what you're making. And they'll think that you're saying we shouldn't teach science at all. And you're going, no, I didn't say that at all. Are you following me?
Yeah, I was following you. The way you were putting that across sounded like it was debating for dummies.
Yeah, well, believe me, most of your debates, there's a thing, I almost got it, but the kids probably wouldn't like it. It has Denzel Washington in it, and it's called The Debate. And it's a black college that learns debate. They have a debate club. And they get into a debate league, and they work. And it's your classic, you know, oppressed black scenario, like Remember the Titans and all these guys. And they're now going to debate against these white honkies at Harvard. And I don't know how it turns out, and they're going to have this, and they're preparing for this mega overwhelming debate with these Harvard dudes, and I kind of want to watch it. But I forget why I brought that up. But you had said, oh, debate for dummies. Most people treat debate very flippantly, okay? But these guys took it seriously. I kind of wanted to watch it because, you know, truth is truth, and you can tease out and find the truth if you really do it right, and that's what this is about. False dilemma. This fallacy occurs when the arguer tries to reduce a situation to a false situation. It's an either-or situation, that's what it is. Either we abolish the federal personal income tax and replace it with a national sales tax, or our country's economy will collapse. Now, is that true?
No,
it's an either-or. Either we do this or we're ruined. It's either this or that. No, sometimes there's a third option. In this statement, the arguer is claiming that we have no choice. Either the country's economy collapses, or we replace the income tax with sales tax. This is a false dilemma. It's not true. It's not going to happen. Because there are other measures we could take to avoid economic collapse besides instituting a sales tax. And the income tax alone will not inevitably cause our economy to collapse. So, these things all come from the book here that you've got, and I think they're fantastic. They give you illustrations of how we usually argue. And you got to stop. Because when I have you do your preliminary arguing, you'll find out I use six different false, fallacy, logical argument means that I got to stop. I got to just stick to the argument and prove my point. Not bring up straw men or attack the opponent, so on and so forth. Now, conclusion. Becoming a person who can use logic well and spot logical fallacies is the reason... In the reasoning of others, takes time and practice. However, the time and effort it'll take will well worth your while, because you can use logic to analyze the claims of advertisers, newspaper articles, book authors, and professors, and priests, and religionists. I love it, man, when I'm talking to a priest. I've got to witness to and interview and try to win 13 different Irish priests. I'm waiting for my 14th one that will sit down with me. But each one of them, their arguments are, they're just, they have no arguments. They will hum and haw all over the place. And when you spot them, you don't attack and go, oh, you're using the ad hominem argument, or this or that. You know how to bring them back onto track. That's the point. You know how to keep them, like you know the way of the master, where it says, you know, where did Cain get his wife? What are they doing? They're trying to create a new problem. They're trying to create a straw man to get you off of the focus. All right. Well, how do you know the Bible's true? How do you know the King James Bible is the only word of God? That does not equal my argument, not my point. You're missing the point. And so you'll know how to be able to deal with them and say, you know, that's not even in the discussion, and get them back on track. You can apply these skills to your life as a citizen by using them to evaluate the arguments of politicians for whom you will vote someday. The challenge is to use these skills to present the gospel in a very ill-informed and pagan society. Most importantly, you can develop your logical skills in a way that helps you better love God with all your heart, soul, and your mind. So here's your assignment. You've got questions by next week, 1 to 4 on page 23. Do exercise number 2 on page 23 and read pages 25 to 28 in your textbook. So now you're getting into your textbook. You should have already read your first chapter and read up to by now. Let me ask you a couple questions before we finish ourselves. Is everything in the Bible reasonable and logical?
No.
I mean, a man telling the sun and the moon to stand still, is that reasonable? And it actually doing it? Is that reasonable? Is it even logical that it could ever happen? So not everything in the Bible is reasonable or logical. Don't get the idea that you can apply debate to every area of the Christian life. There are some things you settle foundational truths. You find out the Bible is true. You test it. You find out, you discover certain things are valid, and then you build your house on that, not having to test everything. So there's some things in the Bible that are just, man. Can a woman pour continuously out of one vessel oil and fill up a whole room full of other buckets and vases? It's not logically possible. So you have to allow for miracles. Okay? You have to allow for the unreasonable. That's why I pray. Amen? So, what we're learning can only go so far. This is not the answer to the world's problems. The just shall live by faith. So logic is a component of faith, but it is no substitute for faith. What am I saying? Lisa, what is the conclusion?
Faith.
Yeah, but my faith is based upon logic, but it does not end with logic. It ends with God, okay? I can go so far, and this is where a rationalist, this is where an agnostic, He finds certain facts and truths, and boy, the debates are strict and they're good, but they cannot allow that something is beyond their comprehension. And if they can't figure it out, they can't believe it. Mm-hmm. All right? And so you're going to have to realize in your debate, sometimes on the door, logic's not going to win them. Your logic's not going to get them saved. For the preaching is the cross of the cross is to them that perish, what will it always ever be?
Foolishness.
Okay. So, I'm just trying to put a balance on this thing. So we look at fallacies of logic and how important logic is. Logic has its place, and it's good for starting, but all we have to look in their eyes and say, you know that there's something inside of you that's going to live forever. And if you want to know the God who made you, his name is Jesus. And you're speaking now at another level. And that's what soul winners do, okay? Start with logic. It's reasonable, but make sure it ends with Jesus Christ and faith in him. All right? Let's stand, let's stretch and pray. Finish up here.